Thank you very much for the invitation to come here. It's a pleasure to be back to PI. So today I'm going to talk about some relatively recent work.
Your microphone?
Sorry?
Are you going to put your microphone on?
I guess I can. So is this good?
Thank you.
Sounds good. Okay, so I'm going to talk about some recent work on the use of something called a Mellin transform, which is useful for conformal field theory correlation functions, and how you use this transform in the context of ADS-CFT to simplify calculations. So first, let me just point out some very interesting work related to what I'm going to talk about, done by Fitzpatrick, Kaplan, Benedon, Jarajo, and Rees, which came out on the same day as my paper. Also work by Miguel Costa, João Benedon, David Pohn, and Slava Rishkov on the embedding formalism for tensors, which I will talk about in this talk. And also, this work was built on the works of Mack and Benedon in 2010, which started applying the work of Mack to ADS-CFT. And so some of the calculations I'll mention were first done by them. And just a small disclaimer is that there's a lot of factors of 2, pi, and so on, which I'll not bother about throughout this talk. So I'll start with some motivation, then a discussion of how you compute scalar amplitudes in ADS-CFT using some new methods, and then currents, how you do this for currents. So what I'm going to talk about boils down to 2 tools that you can use to compute correlation functions in ADS-CFT, although it's slightly more general than this. You don't have to use it in ADS-CFT. You can use it to compute loop integrals, for instance. All you need is that there's you're computing things in position space. You can do this transform to Mellin space to simplify your calculations. And another something that helps is working with the embedding formalism. So what are these 2 things? So embedding formalism will help us because it makes conformal symmetry manifest. And it's simply the idea that the conformal group can be seen as the Lorentz group in higher dimensions. So the conformal group in D dimensions can be seen as the Lorentz group. So SO D plus 1 comma 1. So it's just Lorentz symmetry in D plus 2 dimensions. Mellin space we'll use because it's essentially a transform that you can do on your amplitudes, which has simple analytic properties. This is what you want. You want things which have simple analytic properties because they're easier to characterize. And once you put these 2 tools together, the computation of correlators in ADS-CFT, and especially tree-level correlators, simplifies drastically. So a summary of this talk is that we'll find strong evidence for the existence of Feynman rules for Mellin amplitudes. When I say Mellin amplitude, it's simply this Mellin transform of a usual CFT amplitude. So I'll show evidence for the existence of Feynman rules in the scalar sector and possibly for current and stress tensor correlators. What this means in practice is that give me a Witten diagram, I can immediately tell you what the Mellin amplitude is without any other calculations to be performed. Just like if you looked at the diagram in some flat space theory, you can immediately write down what's its momentum space version at tree level. It's just algebraic. A second important point is that finding a general set of conformally invariant index structures is essentially a trivial task now using the embedding formalism. So if you want to compute the endpoint function of the stress tensor, you can immediately guess what will be the possible index structures that can appear without doing any thinking. Another nice thing is that we'll see that in these calculations in ADS, conformal invariance of the index structures comes about in a very nice way. It comes about essentially by the action of some projectors on simpler index structures. And these simpler index structures essentially look like flat space ones. So what this means is that, for instance, imagine that you want to compute the correlation function of some three currents. Well, we know what the three-point vertex is for Young-Mills theory. It's eta k1 minus k2 plus permutations. So you act on this with some projectors, and this will give you the current three-point function in the CFT. So with these methods, it seems like the stress for tensor four-point function calculation seems feasible. And in this talk, I will talk about a current four-point function. So very briefly, what are these two methods? So one is, I told you about the embedding formalism. And the idea is that you think of ADS space and its conformal boundary as some hypersurfaces living in D plus 2 Minkowski space. So as I said, the conformal group can be identified with the Lorentz group. So ADS is just the hyperboloid. And the boundary of ADS is essentially the projective light cone. So points which are null and which are identified up to a rescaling. That's the boundary of ADS. So it's been known that a long time that the projective light cone is essentially RD. So these ideas go back to Dirac, and I'll talk about them in more detail later. But essentially, in this way, conformal symmetry becomes very simple to implement because it's essentially just Lorentz symmetry. Okay? And seems to be more than a mathematical trick, as I'll try to give you some evidence during this talk. Now, Mellin space. What's this Mellin space and why should we introduce it? If you consider some generic field theory, usually coordinate space amplitudes are not very simple, even for free theories. And so usually you go to momentum space. And this is fine if you have theories which are almost free or where you have Poincaré symmetry. But this is not so good if you have a conformal field theory or if you have some strongly coupled theories. And one way of seeing this is that in a conformal field theory, we know what the two-point function in position space is. So it takes this form. So if I go into momentum space, the only thing I have to do is shift this exponent. And in general, this will not be an integer. It won't be 2, that's for sure. So it could be some fractional power, for instance. So in general, you already have branch cuts, even in the two-point function. So what you want is a better representation where the analytic properties are simpler. So this was essentially introduced by Mack a couple of years ago. So let's consider the correlation function in a conformal field theory of some scalar fields with conformal dimensions delta I. So this is this object here. The Mellin transform is defined in this way. So we identify this correlator in position space with this object. So it's some integral over the complex plane of some parameters delta I j. I runs from 1 to n, the number of fields. But there are some constraints. So delta ij should be symmetric. Delta ii is 0. And this sum, when you sum for a fixed I over all possible j's, it has to add up to the conformal dimension. This guy, by definition, is the Mellin transform of this amplitude. I could have kept these gamma functions inside the Mellin transform. But in many cases of interest, such as in ADS-CFT or for perturbative theories, it's a useful definition because these gamma functions essentially always pop up. So you can one way of understanding this constraint is that originally your correlation function, it has some scaling symmetry. When you do a dilatation run of the coordinates, it has to scale with the appropriate weights, delta 1 through delta n. But now the coordinate dependence is completely captured by this factor here. So if I do a dilatation on one of the x's, you want these exponents to add up in such a way that you recover the original scaling. So this is the origin of this constraint. Now, what Mack noticed is that the beautiful way of solving these constraints is by introducing a set of conserved momenta. So you rewrite this delta ij as an internal product of ki dot kj. You impose that ki squared is equal to minus the conformal dimension, and that the sum of the k's are 0. So think of this as some set of auxiliary momenta. And then the Mellin amplitudes will be functions of Mandelstam invariants. So this is the first hint that we're onto something interesting, that we can write it in terms of these presumably fake momenta. But as we'll see, the Mellon amplitudes look precisely like some amplitudes in momentum space, if I call these guys the momenta. Okay, so actually there is a physical meaning to these momenta. Right, so what I want to emphasize is that the Mellon amplitudes will be some functions of Mandelstam variables. Now, what about the analytic structure? So why is this a useful definition? It's a useful definition if you have conformal field theories, because in conformal field theories you have an OPE expansion. So it means that if you take one operator close to another, you can essentially replace it by some sum over primary operators and their descendants. And so now if I do a dilatation, you see that because of this discrete sum over primary operators, the behaviors and the dilatations are strongly restricted. Okay? They fall onto some integer, onto some discrete lattice, as long as the spectrum of primary operators is discrete. So these behaviors and the dilatations, so since the dependence on the coordinates in the Mellon transform is completely captured through this vector, I can only pick up these discrete behaviors if the Mellon amplitude has poles in these coordinates located at these specific points. Okay? So that's the idea. The Mellon amplitude has to have poles at the position of primary operator fields. So knowing the poles of the Mellon transform amounts to knowing the spectrum of primary operators contributing to a certain correlation function. And as you can guess, the residues of these poles will simply be the OPE coefficients. Okay? And they will factorize. So this is a somewhat heuristic argument, of course, but things have been made pretty precise by Mack in his paper. He considered a scalar four-point function, and using the field shadow field formalism, he computed the Mellon transform of a given conformal partial wave. So he proved this very precisely, and he showed that, for instance, if you're looking at the four-point function and you look at the 1-2 channel, these Mellon amplitudes have to have poles in that Mandelstam variable, so S12, the center of mass energy, if you want. It has to have poles at a mass squared, which is equal to the conformal dimension minus the spin, so the twist. This is called the leading pole corresponding to this primary. And then there's an infinite set of satellite poles labeled by n. And these roughly correspond to the contribution of descendants. Okay? So further, the residues, there will be known polynomials of order LP, LP is the spin, in the remaining independent Mandelstam invariable. So if I say that it's S and T, then I can figure out what's the field that's propagating in a given line by looking at the residue. Because if the residue contains a given power of T, that corresponds to a field of particular spin. So this is how you can discover the spectrum. You find the poles, and if I just tell you the pole is at 2, I don't know what that 2 means. If it's a conformal dimension, if it's a twist. So if I want to figure out the spin, I look at the residue. If there's a T there, I know that the spin is 1. And from that, I can deduce the conformal dimension. Okay, so by looking at poles and residues, I can deduce the spectrum, and further, the residues, so there are these polynomials, times the OPE coefficients, which split between left and right on the diagram. So there's factorization. So if you know the poles and you know the residues, you know all the information that you need about the CFT. So when are these things useful? I think they're useful in general, simply because analytically they only have simple poles. But they will be especially useful if you have conformal field theories where there aren't too many primary operators. And even perturbative field theories, they already have an infinite number of operators. There's single trace operators, but then there's an infinite set of double trace operators. But they come neatly packaged. So essentially the double trace operators will come in through those gamma functions. So Basically, I don't have to worry about them. They always come in a nice form. So if there aren't too many primary operators, the Mellon amplitude will be simple. It will be much simpler than the corresponding position space expression. Now, precisely, weakly coupled theories and weakly coupled gravity theories in ADS define such conformal field theories because I only see single and double trace operators. And another reason why this is useful is because these amplitudes, they clarify the physics of your correlator. So you look at the poles, you understand what's going on. You understand what are the operators being exchanged. You understand what the OPE coefficients are. So the structure is really made physically manifest through this transform. Just like when you go into momentum space, it's the same thing. You look at the diagram and you understand, oh, there's a propagator. It means there's a particle being propagated on this line of a certain mass. You can read off the couplings and so on. So this is the analog thing for conformal field theories. So let me just give you a simple example. So perhaps the simplest non-trivial correlator that you can compute in ADS is a contact interaction in phi to the fourth theory. So there's no internal lines. Or if you prefer, this is connected to box integrals. So the box integral in phi to the fourth theory would correspond to D1111. Okay? So it's just a one loop integral with four propagators. If you compute that, well, the result is what it is. It's this thing. Some integral, there's some Schwinger parameters here, and then there's this exponential. So if you want to extract information from this expression in position space, well, it's not trivial. It's not trivial to get it. But now let me tell you what happens when you do the Mellin transform. Well, the Mellin transform of this function is 1. Okay? Why is it 1? Because it's a contact interaction. I look at a contact interaction, if I think of something in momentum space, it's just the coupling constant. So that's why I get 1 here. Of course, the physics is hidden in those gamma functions, which always appear. So the non-trivial information is all here, but it's also very simple to understand what's going on. So let's take a given gamma function, for instance, gamma of delta 1, 2. Recall that this is k1.k2. So if I rewrite it in terms of the Mendelstam invariant, S, it's just gamma of delta 1 plus delta 2 minus S. This gamma function has poles when S is equal to delta 1 plus delta 2 plus 2n. And what are these guys? Well, they're just the double trace operators I told you that had to be there. Okay? So you look at the gamma function, you can immediately see that these operators are there. If you want to figure out OPE coefficients, you compute the residue. So it's trivial. Whereas obtaining it from here is very messy. So let's get started. So I'm going to show how you do this in practice for scalar amplitudes in ADS-CFT. So for those of you who aren't very familiar with this, so you certainly know how to compute things in position space and flat space theories. The only thing that happens in ADS that's significantly different is that you have to distinguish between internal lines and external lines in that, so we call these bulk to boundary propagators, and these guys are different from bulk to bulk propagators. Even though bulk to bulk propagators, if you take a limit, they reduce to the bulk to boundary ones. So what you have to do is you have to tell me what's the boundary to bulk propagator and what is the bulk to bulk propagator. And then for every one of these lines, you write down one of these propagators. The vertices, you can just read them off from the Lagrangian. And then you just instructed, as usual, to integrate over all positions where the interaction can occur. And that's it. The problem is that you're in ADS, so these are ADS integrals. And these propagators, if you don't write them correctly, they look, well, they look complicated. So doing these integrals is not necessarily a trivial thing. And that's why, before this work, people essentially wouldn't go beyond the four-point function. So how are we going to do this? We're going to do this in this embedding formalism, which goes back to Dirac, as I said. So you think of ADS as some hyperboloid in D plus 2 Minkowski space. The boundary is just given by homogeneous coordinates on the light cone, so things which square to 0, which are identified to scale. And in practice, we're using light cone coordinates for these two extra directions, so we can write these parametrizations. And it's easy to check that with these parametrizations, if you take the internal product of two p's, you just recover yi minus yj squared, which is the usual thing. And p dot x gives you this expression, And this is something very familiar because this is simply what occurs in the bulk-to-boundary propagator in ADS. So the bulk-to-boundary propagator of a scalar can be written in this language as 1 over minus 2 p dot x to the conformal dimension. And now what we do is that we introduce a Schwinger parameter to exponentiate this denominator. Okay, so this is our expression for the bulk-to-boundary propagator. And as we'll see, it's crucial that we always use these Schwinger parameters. And this is very nice, because now I have an exponential of p dot x. So this looks a lot like things in flat space. And essentially, whenever I have a derivative interaction, all I have to do is drop a p, just like I would in flat space. So derivative interactions in this formalism, they're essentially trivial. They're just like in flat space. I just pull down a p. So what about the bulk-to-bulk propagator? Well, people usually write it in terms of some hypergeometric function. So I'm going to write it in a seemingly more complicated fashion. So there's some Mellin integral over the complex plane of some function, which I give down here. Then there's a boundary integral of Q, and then there's this thing. So this might not look like anything, but in fact, this is simply the product of two bulk-to-boundary propagators that I wrote down previously with given conformals dimensions, h plus c and h minus c, and they're glued together via these integrations. So this integration is like you're integrating over all possible dimensions, and this glues the boundary point. So diagrammatically, what I'm doing is that whenever I have a bulk-to-bulk propagator, I can think of it as two bulk-to-boundary propagators appropriately glued. Okay? The physics of which particle is propagating is contained in this function. This function will have a pole at the location of the conformal dimension of the field that's propagating on that line. Okay? But this is very nice because it tells me that, at least in phi cube theory, if I know the three-point vertex, I don't have to worry about ADS integrations anymore. Once I know the three-point functions, ADS completely drops out of the picture. So you can think of ADS as a tool for giving you the three-point function. Once you know that, then this is just some regular CFT calculation. So let's do it. Let's compute the three-point function, because then it will be much simpler. So this is very simple. So I have three operators, so three bulk-to-boundary propagators. So there will be three Schwinger parameters, three exponentials. You multiply them, they all add up. And now I'm instructed to do the ADS integration. I won't do it in detail here, but I don't know, it's a few lines of calculation. It's very simple because I have an exponential. And what essentially happens is that when you do this integral, you get this, whatever's multiplying x squares, and I pick up a gamma function. So this squaring comes from the fact that the ADS coordinates are, there's an x, and there's an x mu, and there's an x naught. The integration over x mu will be Gaussian, so it will square whatever is hitting it, which will be this. The x naught integration will pick up a gamma function. Okay, so this is very simple to see. So we do the integration, this guy squares, but since the p squares are zero, I just get a sum over cross products in the exponential. And here's the gamma function I mentioned before. Okay? So now I have to do these Schwinger parameter integrals, but notice that they're all jumbled up here in the exponential. So in general, I will not be able to unjumble them. I have to do some trick. But for the particular case of 3 points, I can do a coordinate transformation which will diagonalize this sum. So then I can do the integrals. I will pick up three gamma functions. And so here's the result. G times that first gamma function. Then I pick up three gamma functions from the Schwinger parameter integrals. And this is just the pi dot pj. Okay? So I've written it already in terms of something which I've called delta j. But here, there's no integration. So these delta i's are actually some fixed parameters that I know what they are. So I give them down here. But first, so let me just, you look at this, and you look at the expression for the Mellin transform, and it's easy to read off what the Mellin amplitude is. It's just a number. Any contact interaction, the Mellin transform is always a number. It's just a coupling constant. So I get g times the gamma function. And so the reason why I don't see an integral is that the constraints on the delta ij's, if there's only three of them, it completely fixes them. Okay, this is just the statement that if you have momentum conservation, a three-point vertex, momentum conservation fixes everything. So you can check that using the constraints, these delta ij's reduce to this thing, and this is just the usual result in a CFT. The three-point function in a CFT has these exponents. Okay? So we know the Mellin amplitude for the three-point function. And we know the three-point function, which is very important. So now I'm going to start computing some exchange diagrams. So as I told you, I can always write an exchange diagram as the gluing of some contact interactions in an appropriate way. So since I've already done the ADS integration once, I don't need to do it anymore. So no more ADS integrals. But I still need to do the boundary integrations. But once again, since I have an exponential, the boundary integration is also trivial. It does essentially the same thing. So it's just a Gaussian integration. So I mean, you have to remember that this is a projective coordinate, so I have to replace the parameterization. So this will be x minus something squared. So when you do the integral, it's just a Gaussian integral. And essentially, it just squares whatever is multiplying it. Okay? So those integrals are also simple. So the only things that are left to do are these Mellin integrals, and then there's going to be a bunch of Schwinger parameter integrals. Okay? So a generic amplitude will look something like this, so don't get scared. In fact, I've even omitted the Mellin integrals here, but there will be a bunch of Schwinger parameter integrals times some exponential. So I've done all the integrals, things I've squared in the exponential, I'll get some exponential stuff. So now what do? I told you that if I only had three t's, I could diagonalize and do the integrals. In general, I can't. So I'm going to use Semenzik's formula, which says precisely that when I have an integral of this form, I can trade it for the integrals that appear in the Mellin representation. Okay? So this is an old result. I think it's just that Semenzik didn't realize that these guys could be written as some momenta. That was Mach. Okay? So I'm going to trade these integrals for these ones, and then I forget about them because I want to focus on whatever is left. I want to focus on the Mellin amplitude, so the thing that will be sitting inside these integrals. So I never have to explicitly compute the inverse Mellin transform, because when I'm doing these computations, these integrals automatically appear. Okay? So my Mellin amplitude will be whatever is left. What is left? There will be the Mellin integrals, the internal Schwinger parameter integrals. And then, since these Qs, they will not be the Pij's, they'll be Pij times something. So I wrote it down here. I will include them here. Okay? So, okay, maybe this looks a bit formal, but I'll show you now in a concrete example how this works. This is just to show you that systematically, so there's a straightforward way of doing these computations. And in fact, I'm going to show you the four-point function, but if you do the four-point function, you can essentially do any endpoint function you like. The level of difficulty is roughly the same. So let's start with the four-point function. No ADS integrals here. There's only the Mellin integral and the boundary integral of two three-point functions. I do the boundary integral. So this is the resulting expression. So just to understand the structure, here's the external Schwinger parameter integrals, the Mellin integral, the internal integral, so this corresponds to an internal line. These are just the coupling constants of the two three-point functions that I was gluing, so g gamma, g gamma. And then there's an exponential of stuff, of pij's, titj's times something. So this is precisely of the form that I wrote down in the previous slide. So I can trade those integrals for the Mellin integrals. I'll get the Mellin transform. So you do this, the internal Schwinger parameters integrals in this case are very simple, I just get some gamma functions. And at the end of the day, so I'm skipping some details here, straightforward details, I might add, the Mellin amplitude takes this nice simple form, okay? Maybe it doesn't look very nice, but you can understand physically what's going on. So what's this? It's an infinite sum of propagators. And the propagators have poles precisely where Mach had told you they would be. There's a pole at the conformal dimension delta, and then there's the satellite poles, which have to be there because of conformal symmetry. This guy is just some propagator normalization factor. I've defined it, like I've called it this, so it pops out automatically. And then there's something I've called vertices. So in a four-point function, I have two external legs talking to one internal leg. So I need a vertex which talks to two external legs and one internal leg. The internal leg could have a descendant, and the descendant is labeled by n. Therefore, my vertices will have three labels. Well, I have to tell what are the conformal dimensions, and I have to tell whether I'm evaluating it at a given descendant. So this would be the vertex of two external legs of conformal dimensions delta 1, delta 2, no descendant, with a field of dimension delta, descendant n. Okay? So it's just this vertex. And what are these vertices? So I give them here. So the vertex, once I switch on an n, it's equal to the one where there's no n switched on. This was just the three-point function Mellin amplitude I computed before. Switching on the n introduces this Pockhammer symbol. So a Pockhammer symbol is just a n is gamma a plus n divided by gamma a, which means that if I set n to 0, it collapses onto 1. Okay? So it reduces to the previous vertex. So it's consistent. So I think this is very nice. And in fact, I can actually do this sum. So if you don't like infinite series, you could just do this sum, and then you get some hypergeometric function. But this, it's physically clear what's going on in this form. So what have we learned? We've learned that the three-point function is given by this vertex, and the exchange diagram is given by this. Okay? So you look at this, and you can immediately conjecture what will be the form of the Mellin amplitude of a general Witten diagram. The only thing you will need to know is that you need to know the general vertex when there's three legs with a descendant. Okay? So what's the strategy? We're going to propose a set of Feynman rules. Well, it's essentially what I've written down. I mean, you can guess them from here. So I'm going to compute some higher endpoint functions, check that they can be written a la Feynman. And this will also tell us what the vertices are. And everything has to be consistent. If I find the vertex with three ends, it has to collapse onto the previous ones once I set some of the ends to zero, for instance. So I looked at the five-point diagram, six-point diagram. I've also looked at a 12-point diagram. So just the fact that I can say that I looked at a 12-point diagram shows you that these calculations are, well, relatively simple to perform. Because before, people were stuck at 4 points. So let me show you what happens for the six-point function. So the six-point amplitude is just the gluing of 4 3-point functions. So there's some boundary integrals, there's some Mellin integrals, and then there's the 4 3-point functions. The calculation is straightforward. It's just like in the 4-point function case. There is one non-trivial thing. So I'm going to show you a horrible slide now. So this is the Mellin amplitude. So there's a lot of gamma functions in this business. Don't be scared by them. There's just a lot of gamma functions. The point is that in this case, the internal Schwinger parameter integrals do not decouple. They're mixed up. So these are there's three of the integrals which are mixed up through this term. Okay? So these integrals come from the internal lines. So I need to do this integral. Before I just got some beta functions, now I have this more complicated integral. But I can do it. I can do it by doing a multinomial expansion on this term. If I do a multinomial expansion, I can do these integrals. I will get some beta functions, but I'll get an infinite sum of them. So whenever I have an infinite sum of gamma functions, usually what you get is a hypergeometric function. And in this case, you get something called the Lauri-Schelle generalized hypergeometric function of three variables, which is quite a mouthful. But, I mean, you don't care. It just has some definition in terms of a series. It's a sum of some Pockhammer symbols with some variables. So there's a nice, simple definition. So you can just put it on the computer and evaluate it.
Can I ask a simple question? So when you were calculating six-point diagram,
Yes.
And you said that you were showing up three-point functions.
Four, yes.
Four. One of the points was an internal point in the ADS space, whereas when you computed the three-point function on its own, that point was on the boundary. Won't some technicalities change because of that?
Oh, well, what will happen is that the boundary points can talk to each other. So there's a boundary point here, there's a boundary point here, there's a boundary point there. When you're doing these boundary integrals, one of the q's will be talking to some outside p's, but it will also be talking to the other internal q's. Okay? So there will be some mixing. That mixing at the end will turn into the mixing of those Schwinger parameter integrals. So technically there is some difference. But at the end of the day, it just amounts to this term. So the Mellin amplitude can now be obtained. So I'm saying performing pole pinching. So what I'm saying is that this expression is really just the poles of the Mellin amplitude, and there could be finite pieces which are missing that you have to worry about. And well, the only way of figuring out what the finite pieces are is actually by doing those Mellin integrals properly, which I didn't do, but someone should. But they're not expected, so they're not ruled out, but they're not expected, and I'll comment on this later on. So let me just focus on the poles. So what is the amplitudes? Well, it's exactly what you expect. There's three propagators, so maybe it helps if I do the drawing. So the SIs are the Mendelstam invariants associated to each pair of legs. So there will be an overall momentum flowing S1, S2, and S3 here. Okay, so I have three propagators with the corresponding momenta. They have poles precisely where I expect them. The propagator normalizations are the same I had before. And the vertices come out precisely as you expect. I expect to see three vertices which talk to two external lines and one internal line. So these are this guy, and this guy. And there's one vertex which talks to three descendants, which is this guy. So what is this general vertex? Well, it's the lowest order one times some Pockhammer symbols times this Lowry-Shella hypergeometric function. But the parameters of this Lowry-Shella function, there's some negative integers. So that series definition I gave you before, it collapses onto a finite sum. Okay, it's just a handful of terms, which you can put on the computer and evaluate. And you can check that when you start setting n's to 0, it just collapses onto the previous vertices. So the five-point function, which I didn't show you here, you get the vertex when there's two n's switched on, and this guy reduces to that when I switch off one of the n's. Okay? So I have everything now. So I think this is strong evidence that these Feynman rules are true, and I know the vertices, so what are the Feynman rules? Well, it's exactly like you do in momentum space. You look at the Witten diagram, you think of it as a momentum space diagram, so what do? You give momentum to every leg, you impose momentum conservation at each vertex. Every time there's an internal line, you write down a propagator. It's just the propagator you expect. What's the difference? There's some normalization that you need to include, and you can't include just the field in the leg, you also have to include its descendants. You're going to have to sum over all possible descendants. And if I have phi m theory, the general vertex will be a generalization of what I wrote down before. So this time you get a Lowry-Shella function of m variables. So in phi cubed, it's the cubic one. Phi fourth is the quartic one, and so on. So I've only tested that this works up to phi to the fourth theory. But there's a group at Brown University, this should come out soon, that they have proved that this vertex is true. In general. So then I just sum over all possible n's, and that's it. So as I said, 4-point, 5-point, 6-point, and 12-point amplitudes are consistent with these rules. Strictly speaking, I've only showed this for the pole structure. There could be finite pieces missing, but it seems to be ruled out by the results of this other group, Fitzpatrick, Kaplan, and so on. And the argument is that they have some equation that the Mellin amplitude should satisfy, and they explicitly show for scalars, at least in some cases, that these finite pieces have to drop out. They also came up with some Feynman rules, which they checked match mine in some circumstances. They couldn't show it in general because it was very messy. But where they could check, there were none of these polynomial contributions. And this was a general proof, not for a particular diagram. And so actually, in principle, you can test these full rules using this equation. It's just, it's a bit messy, so no one has done it yet, but hopefully someone will. So let me stress that if these rules are true, then tree-level correlation functions in the scalar sector of ADS-CFT are in principle completely understood, in the sense that give me a five-dimensional Lagrangian or a d-dimensional Lagrangian where I have ADS-D. You draw me a Witten diagram, I can immediately tell you what's the Mellon amplitude with no calculations to be done. Okay? Just like you would do for tree-level amplitudes in momentum space. So, any questions?
What about loops?
You can use these methods for loops, and in principle there should be some kind of Feynman rules for loops, but no one's worked it out yet. I think this is work in progress. Also, Jared Kaplan is working on this. So, you won't see integrals, you'll only see sums. So when you have a loop, you will see double trace, so if you have a single loop, you'll see double trace operators. So you'll get an infinite sum of all the double trace operators that can occur, and their descendants, so there's a double sum. And in a certain limit, you can show that this reduces to an integral. But definitely the loop calculations are much simpler using these methods than if you do it in position space. Okay, so I'm going to move on to current amplitudes. So to discuss currents, I want to keep working in this D plus 2-dimensional formalism. So I'm going to have things which have D plus 2-dimensional indices laying around. How do I convert those into D-dimensional ones? You can see that there has to be a constraint, right? Because there isn't the same number of degrees of freedom in D plus 2-dimensions as in D. So the constraint that you need to impose is that your tensors are transverse. So recall this is the projective light cone coordinate. Any tensors that you have, when you hit it with this P, it has to vanish. Okay? Further, if you want to go from this D plus 2-dimensional index to D dimensions, you need some pullbacks. So here they are. So this tells you what the expressions are in terms of the original indices. And I'm going to do, well, it's not a trick, but so imagine that I wanted to measure some correlation function in D dimensions along a certain direction characterized by some polarization tensor epsilon. If I'm given a D plus 2-dimensional amplitude, what I do is that I contract it with the pullback, and then I contract it with epsilon. So I might as well call this object a D plus 2-dimensional polarization tensor. Okay? But this can't be arbitrary. This guy was arbitrary. This guy can't be arbitrary. And one way of seeing it is that this psi secretly includes this factor, dp dx. And so if I dot it with a p, since p squared is 0, it'll vanish. So this dotted with p is 0. So psi is defined up to shifts by p. So here are the conditions. I have p squared is 0 because it's a projective light cone coordinate. Polarization tensor dotted with p is 0. And the polarization tensor can be shifted by a p. So these look kind of like gauge invariance conditions in D plus 2-dimensions. If I think of p as a momentum. That's why I called it a p. But even if you don't believe this, you don't have to. The point is that these constraints are there, and this strongly constrains what possible conformally invariant index structures you can have, because it has to satisfy these properties.
By shifting by p, you mean there's some arbitrary constant in front of the theory.
What I'm saying is that the amplitude, it has to satisfy this. So if I change the definition of my polarization tensor by p, it won't change anything.
No, what I meant was that there is in principle some function that's sitting in front of pi, right?
A function here?
Yeah.
No, it's just this. You have to think of it, it's like their amplitudes in momentum space. So I can shift by a p, by a momentum. Yeah, by an arbitrary factor, sure. Yes.
But that arbitrary factor would also be a
polynomial. Yeah, it could be a function, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just the index structure would be carried by a p. So there are only two structures that satisfy these conditions, at least that I can think of. Maybe you can see something I don't. These two structures look like this. So actually, I think in the literature, people usually call this J. So maybe I should have called this J. Anyway, I will call it I. And then there's this X structure. And you can see, so there should be a 3 here. If I dot this structure with a P3, it vanishes. And this structure, if I dot it with a P1 or with a P2, it also vanishes. Okay? So since there's nothing else I can think of that you can write down, any conformally invariant index structure has to be a polynomial in these structures. And that's it. There's no more thinking to be done. So as an example, current three-point function, I have 3 indices. What can I write down? I can write down 3 x's, or I can write down an I and an x, those permutations. And that's it. There's nothing else I can think of that I can write down. And this precisely agrees with the literature. These are the only things that appear in a current three-point function. Okay? Well, for vector currents. I'm not including axial currents here. But I stress, I mean, these are the only things I can think of. So it's always better to do some tests. And I will show you that in the calculations that I will do, this is always true. I looked at four-point functions, and I can always show that the structures that appear are polynomials in these things. So, right, so I want to do some calculations in ADS-CFT, compute some Witten diagrams with currents, so I need to know the propagators. And now something else that's nice is going to appear. So it's easy to check that the usual current bulk-to-boundary propagator that you write down in x coordinates can be written in this embedding formalism like this. It's easy to check if you act with the pullbacks on these expressions, you will get the usual propagator. And this also has the nice properties that it's transverse on both sides. So if I dot it with a P, it's 0. If I dot it with an X on the other side, it's also 0, which it had to be. Okay? So whatever calculations I do, I'm guaranteed that at the end, the amplitude will be gauge invariant. When I dot it with a P, it will be 0 by construction. But now there's something interesting. So this is just the scalar propagator, right? And then this guy carries the index structure. But since there's an exponential here, every x, I can trade it for a derivative with respect to p. So this, I can trade this object by something I call a d operator, which is eta plus, this just comes out if you actually do the computation, this 1 over delta, p d dp. Okay? And this guy just couples out of the calculation, right? Because it doesn't involve x, it doesn't involve any of the things I'm integrating over. So whenever I'm doing some calculation, I can just pull this d to the outside and leave its action for the end. But what is this d? I claim it's a projector onto the conformally invariant subspace of index structures. So how can you see this? So you'll have some amplitude, which is a bunch of d's acting on some reduced amplitude. And the advantage is that these reduced amplitudes have much simpler index structures than the full amplitude. And in fact, these much simpler index structures look precisely like the flat space ones, at least up to the four-point function level. So these D operators, they enforce the correct behavior under conformal transformations. And one way of seeing it is check for dilatations. Recall that my original amplitude, when I dot it with a P, it has to vanish. But now when I dot it with a P with against this D operator, it's not obvious that it should vanish. But what I see is that it becomes essentially the dilatation operator plus delta. This will vanish only if my amplitude scales in the appropriate way under dilatations. Okay? So in order for this to be 0, the amplitude will have to scale properly. So this is the sense in which I say that this guy is a projector. It projects onto things which satisfy the appropriate conformal transformation properties. I gave you this for currents, but you can write it down for any object which has indices, including the stress tensor. And the simplifications that you will get will be even better, because in the case of the stress tensor, this operator will have 2 derivatives, because there's more indices. So when I act with these operators on this reduced amplitude, I will get some huge mass. But I'm not sure I care. Maybe all I care about is this reduced amplitude, because it contains the same information. And for stress tensors, so you'll get some very strong simplifications. So maybe I'll show this at the end if I have the time. So let's start with a simple example. Current scalar-scalar correlator, so a three-point function. So this is very similar to the scalar-scalar-scalar three-point function. What are the differences? The difference is that now there's an index structure. There's a D operator for every current, so here it is. And then there's the index structure, which is the coupling of the current to the scalars. What is this index structure? So it's a minimally coupled scalar. So I get T1P1 minus T2P2, and this is precisely what you would get in flat space. It's just K1 minus K2. This is the coupling to a current of a minimally coupled scalar. I had to get this because my wave functions, they're just exponentials of P dot X. So when I act with the derivative with respect to X, I will just drop a TP. So it had to be this way. In this case, so now I still have all these integrals to do. So I can do them. So this is the final answer. There's still the action of this D projector on this, so D acts on the full thing, not just on the index structure. But actually, in this case, this is already gauge invariant, so actually the action of this D is essentially trivial. But what I want to emphasize is that you can see, before the action of the D operators, there's a direct map between what I would call the flat space index structure and the conformal index structure. Okay, so it's very similar. You look at one and you can guess what the other one is. So this will be useful. So for instance, 3 points of currents. Now there's three of those projectors acting on some reduced amplitude. And this reduced amplitude is what? It's the same calculation that you would do for three scalars. So here's the exponentials, the Schwinger parameters, and then there's an index structure. And the index structure, it is the one that you would find in Young-Mills theory. Because it had to be. It's just derivatives acting on exponentials. So once again, there's a direct map between the flat space amplitude and the CFT amplitude. So this reduced amplitude, it'll just be, once I do these integrals, it will become this. So you look at this expression, you can guess where it came from. And once I act with the D operators on this, I will recover the result I showed you before. So I'll get three X's and an X and an I. Everything works. I'm also going to show you some exchange diagrams very briefly. But for exchange diagrams, I need the bulk-to-bulk propagator of a current. So the bulk-to-bulk propagator of a current carries two indices. And what's the nice thing is that you can write the bulk-to-bulk propagator, once again, as the gluing of two bulk-to-boundary propagators. Okay? Just like for the scalar. So every time I have an internal line, I can split it into two bulk-to-boundary propagators. Here it's the same thing. So much of the story for currents is exactly the same as for scalars. So first diagram is this, four scalars on the outer legs. The only difference is that there will be an index structure carried here. What is the index structure? Well, it's the same thing as in flat space, k1 minus k2 dot k3 minus k4, as it had to be. You compute the Mellin amplitude, and what do you get? Sum of propagators. The pole of the propagator is at delta minus 1, because recall that the pole is at the twist, and the twist is dimension minus the spin. How do I know the spin? Because there's a polynomial in the numerator of order 1 in the other Mendelssohn invariant. So I know it's a field of spin 1 that's being propagated. This gamma 1, 2 is k1 minus k2 dot k3 minus k4, where these guys are now the Mellin momenta. And then I get some vertices, and these vertices are very similar to the scalar ones. There's just a small shift. So this suggests that probably there's also Feynman rules for the current sector. Finally, I will compute the current four-point function. And it's very similar to the case where it's four scalars. It's very, very similar. It's not much difficult. The only difficulty is that there will be more momenta floating around. So when I do the boundary integrals, this would complicate things. So I don't want internal coordinates with three indices, but I can use a trick. And so this is the most remarkable thing for me, is that there is a notion of momentum conservation here. So the sum of the TPs that talk to a given vertice, if they're acted on by this D projector, and there's these Schwinger parameters here to help you out, this is actually zero. Okay, so this is what I call momentum conservation. Okay, so this for me was completely unexpected, but actually there's a simple way of understanding it. The reason is that whenever I have a vertex couples an X to a sum of TPs, right? So imagine that I have an X with a free index here. I know that these guys are not allowed because there's always this transversality property. XA dotted into something has to kill it. So whatever this is zero. But now when I do the X integral, I can trade this by a derivative with respect to the momenta, the sum of the TPs. I do the integral, this squares. So when I act with the derivative, it just drops a sum of TP downstairs. Okay? But since I know that that was zero originally, it still has to be zero. Oh. So this helps you out in the calculation. And to me, this is another piece of evidence that there's probably some nice D plus two dimensional description of the physics, where these P's are actually momenta. So very briefly, what do you get for the contact diagram in Young-Mills theory? Well, you get the one, you get the flat space one index structure, but then I still have all these four projectors acting on it. When you do that, it spits out a mass. That mass is some polynomial in the I's and X's that I defined before. Finally, the more interesting diagram, the more complicated one, is this one. So I think I skipped a lot of the details. Yes, I'm just going to show you the answer. But it's not very complicated. It's very similar to when it's four scalars. So what happens? What happens is that the exchange part looks exactly like that of a scalar. So there's a current being exchanged. The current is dimension d minus 1. Minus the spin, it's d minus 2, so this is the twist. And then there's an index structure. And in fact, you can show that for d equals 4, this collapses onto this simple thing. So I thought this was very nice. But the point, so what is this index structure? Well, the index structure, when you're doing the calculation, there will be two currents coupling, and these are simply the three-point vertices of Young-Mills. And then I'm supposed to act with these d operators. So the point is that to determine that index structure, all I have to do is take the Young-Mills index structure, apply this rule. This rule just tells you that when I have Ti, Tj, Pi, Pj, I write it like this when I do the Schwinger parameter integrals, and that's it. So the index structure is very closely related to the Young-Mills one. Of course, at the end, I'm going to have to act with these D operators, and that will give you some big mass. And once again, I check that that big mass is actually a simple polynomial in the index structures I showed you at the beginning. Okay, so I think that's it. So I hope to have convinced you that this Mellin space is very useful whenever you have objects with conformal symmetry. I've discussed ADS-CFT computations, but you can use this for computing tree-level correlation functions in phi to the fourth theory, or the same thing, conformal loop integrals. This will give you extremely simple expressions for those. Further, Mellin amplitudes in this context seem to be described by a simple set of Feynman rules, and the same is true for phi to the fourth theory at tree level. It also has a set of simple rules for the position space correlation functions. And so in principle, we have solved the scalar sector at tree level. This embedding formalism seems to go hand in hand with the Mellin representation, because I need those Schwinger parameters. And I hope to have convinced you that it seems to be more of a trick, more than a trick. So all these nice conditions of gauge invariance, that I have polarization tensors with the right properties, and that you even find some kind of momentum conservation at each vertex, to me these are clues that there might be some nice D plus two-dimensional description of the physics. And so let me just leave you with a list of open questions. Thank you.